Well, thank you very much for coming. My name is Karen Sturm. I'm the lecturer of human rights at Human Rights Consortium. And I'm going to talk to you today about some aspects of my ongoing and hopefully future research. Before doing that, of course, I'd like to thank the Dean's Office and Sally and Sandrine in particular for giving this opportunity to present my work, and to Troy for organising it, of course. But thank you very much for coming. Hopefully there's some interesting discussion following my presentation. I hope to limit myself to 45 to 50 minutes, which should leave us plenty of time for a discussion and question. However, being aware that I am the judge, so to speak, of my own time, I may stray a bit beyond 45, 50 minutes. Nevertheless, what I would like to talk to you today about is the inter-American human rights system, and with particular reference to Argentina. Given what I expect most of you not being familiar with the inter-American system, I'm going to spend quite some time talking through a particular case to give you some flavour of how the system works in the case of Argentina. So I'm going to start with an illustration of a particular case of human rights violation that has ended up before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and that's the case of Walter Bulacio. Then I'm going to talk quite briefly about the formal aspects of the Inter-American system, putting emphasis on its development over time, and particularly how to think about its impact in the region. And then I'm going to talk more broadly about the case of Argentina and the inter-American human rights system, and looking at what I call a particular actor-oriented perspective of the impact of the inter-American system, looking at its impact on human rights organizations, looking at its impact on domestic judiciary, and looking at its impact on state institutions, state bureaucracies. And then finally, hopefully, I'm going to end up by saying something very short on the broader significance of this research, and hopefully some of the future directions. All right. Now, Walter Bulacio. So I'm going to tell the story of Walter Bulacio to give you a sense of, if you will, the human side of human rights violations and the human side of cases being brought into the American system. And I'm giving you here the timeline of the Walter Bulacio case. Now, in April 1999, Walter Bulacio was arbitrarily detained by the Federal Police of Buenos Aires when he tried to enter a stadium to attend a rock concert. The arrest was part of a planned detention of around 70 people. This is the type of practice by the Buenos Aires police called a razzia. And this detention included several minors. At the police station, Walter was mistreated. The following day, he was taken to a hospital without either his parents or a juvenile judge having been notified of his detention, which is a clear violation of applicable laws. Now, because of his mistreatment, Walter died 5 days later. No police officer was held responsible for the arbitrary detention. None was held responsible for the mistreatment while detained, and his subsequent death.
Sorry,
yeah.
Did you say you mentioned parents? How old was he?
He was 17 at the time of detention, I believe. Yeah. This was the start of the Bulacio case, okay, which became an emblematic representation of the type of violent practices of the Buenos Aires police force. There was an intense social mobilization around this particular case, predominantly led by youth groups. And this sparked a public and parliamentary debate regarding the power of the police to arrest people without a warrant. There were some modifications of laws following these debates, but the criminal investigation of Walter's death became entangled in deliberate delaying tactics of the defense lawyers representing the police officers. Now, in May 1997, an organization called COREPI, which you see that's organized the manifestation picture here, together with a regional human rights organization based in Washington, D.C. called Sehil, and a national human rights organization in Argentina called CELS. They submitted jointly a petition on behalf of the Velazquez family to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And they alleged that the state had violated the rights to freedom and personal safety of Walter Velazquez, the personal integrity to life, judicial guarantees, and effective remedies. In effect, translating the real fate of Walter Velazquez into a legal jargon. The proceedings before the Inter-American Commission lasted 4 years. During this period, there were several attempts to reach a friendly settlement between the Walter Velazquez family and the Argentine state. But in the end, the Argentine state at the time refused to modify the laws governing the detention of individuals by the police without an arrest warrant. Now, in January 2001, the Commission concluded that the human rights of Walter and his family had been violated and submitted the case to the Inter-American Court. So in its submission, with the support of the petitioners, that is Walter's family, the Inter-American Commission asked the Inter-American Court to declare the Argentine state responsible for the human rights violation, for the continuing violation of Walter Velazquez's family's rights and judicial guarantees, and also asked the Inter-American Court to determine what would be appropriate compensation. In February 2003, this is quite significant, after a date had already been set for the hearings before the Inter-American Court, the then president of Argentina, Eduardo Duhalde, he signed a presidential decree through which the Argentine state recognized its full responsibility of the human rights violations in the Velazquez case and affirmed the intention of the state to accept reparations, without whatever reparations that the Inter-American Court would set. The decree, in many ways, constituted, from the perspective of the president, a act of public apology for the violations that Walter had suffered. Now, following the adoption of this presidential decree, the Velazquez family, the Argentine government, and the Commission signed an agreement which ratified the recognition of state responsibility and which also set out a plan for implementation of reparation and reform of legislation. In September 2003, the Inter-American Court issued its sentence in the Velazquez case. And I just want to briefly go through the elements of this sentence to get a sense of what the Inter-American Court seeks to do. Now, it ordered the Argentine state to continue and conclude the domestic criminal investigations that were still ongoing in Argentina, and to sanction those who were responsible for the violations suffered by Walter. And it also urged and demanded that the family of Walter Velazquez would have full participation in this process. It also established that the Argentine judiciary had been responsible for what it called undue delays and obstacles that had led to effective impunity, and that Argentine courts could not invoke prescription clauses, okay? So that this was an ongoing violation that could not be prescribed. In relation to the norms and practices of policing, the court characterized these delacias as incompatible with the respect for fundamental rights, including the presumption of innocence, the existence of an arrest warrant, so on and so forth. Okay, and particularly it emphasized the fact that the state and the police has special responsibilities when it comes to minors. The court also ordered Argentina to improve general conditions for people in detention in general and for minors in particular. And it urged, and it gave this a particular urgency given the state of the detention facilities and the type of policies adopted by the police forces, vis-a-vis minors in particular. So it was a specific urgency that this should not be repeated. And importantly, the court ordered measures of reparation, which included symbolic reparation, such as publishing the sentence, make sure that the sentence was publicly diffused and so on and so forth, and financial compensation to the Bulacio family. The amount of compensation set by the court was at the level of $400,000, which, according to the court, especially took into account the grave circumstances of the case, the intensity of the suffering that the case had caused the victim and his family, and the changing in family's living conditions. Okay. So, very specific set of recommendations and demands by the court, as well as more general attempts to do something about the type of practices and norms within the police force. However, shortly after the 6 months that the court had given to the Argentine state to implement these provisions, the commission, together with the petitioners, informed the court that the decision had only been partially complied with. So the financial compensation had been paid in full, but the obligation to investigate, prosecute, and punish those responsible for the illegal detention and death of Walter Bulacio, and also the more general changes in legislation that was still pending. Okay, so the Argentine state found it was able to pay compensation in terms of money, but was not able or not willing to implement more broader reforms. Now, in 2004, the Argentine Supreme Court issued a ruling by which it ordered the reopening of the criminal investigation in the Bulacio case and grounding its decision in the resolution issued by the Inter-American Court. And just to kind of give you a sense of the ongoing nature of this case, I have here the 2008 resolution by the Inter-American Court, and if you read towards the end, the compliance with the decision is still pending by the end of 2008. And as I understand, in the case of Walter Bulacio, many of the elements of the Inter-American Court's decision still pending today. Okay, so what then do I want to say about all this? Okay, what does all this mean? What does this story illustrate? First, I think it illustrates something about human rights in democratic Argentina today, and also it illustrates some of the potential influence by the American system, as well as some very significant constraints. So first, it reveals some of the continuing, yet changing character of human rights violations in Argentina following its democratic transition in 1983. Now, for those of you who are familiar with Argentina, as you know, there have been a series of democratically elected governments, and the military has safely returned to their barracks. And this, of course, has led to a significant improvement in general conditions of human rights in the country compared to the period of the military junta that has ruled the country since 1983. Yet the Bulacio case, I argue, illustrates that sustained and structural human rights violations continue to take place. Now, although agents of the state are clearly responsible for the violations suffered by Walter and his family, there is no systematic and deliberate set of policies on the part of the Argentine government that explains what happened to Walter. The police officers who abused Walter did not operate with orders from high above. Okay? Rather, the story of Walter Bulacio and the violations he suffered are a consequence of repressive practices of policing that perhaps could be best explained by an authoritarian culture within the various police institutions in Argentina. Now, these authoritarian practices need to be understood in the context of what is multiple forms of violence in Argentine society, and of course the ways in which Argentine state has always been different from what could be seen as a neat Weberian model of having a monopoly on violence. So we have to understand this type of violence and this type of human rights violations in the broader context of Argentine democracy. Especially with regards to what is widespread and diffused forms of violence, unequal citizenship rights in practice, and especially as experienced by youth. Also, for those who are more familiar with the Latin American setting, of course, the Argentine case is nothing exceptional. It also shows, I believe, the nature of what deeply problematic responses by the state, both in terms of its failure to provide remedies for specific human rights violations, but also to address structural problems by reforming state institutions. So Walter Blasi is a specific case of structural human rights violations, but the causes do not lie in the exercise of arbitrary state power, but rather as a consequence of the weakness of state institutions and failure to act. And the capacity of the weak and inefficient state institutions as a whole to address such violations is extremely limited, as we've seen in the case of Walter. And thirdly, it also shows the inadequacy of judicial responses. Now, the judiciary in a democracy has the function to be a guarantor of rights. In this case, and in so many others, we've seen the Argentine judiciary fail to fulfill this function. Again, it's not necessarily a consequence of a systematic plan to violate people's rights, but more a case of judicial inertia, ineptitude, and low-level collusion with specific particular police officers. The story, I believe, also shows the importance of continuing civil society mobilization around human rights. The Blasi case became paradigmatic in many ways for parts of Argentine society for reasons that I could explain in Q&As. But the mobilization on part of human rights organization led to some limited reforms. However, I would also say, when looking at human rights organizations in Argentina, it also reveals some of the reluctance on the part of traditional human rights organizations to deal with these type of cases of violations, in part because it goes beyond understandings of what human rights actually mean in the context of Argentina. This is not a case of past human rights abuses by military forces. This has to do with marginalized sectors of society that have not a very particularly strong voice, and these type of cases are not necessarily taken up by traditional human rights organizations in Argentina. Moving to the Inter-American system, the Blasi case, I believe, demonstrates some of the opportunities provided by the Inter-American system, but also some very significant constraints. So in terms of the multiple ways, I believe, the Inter-American system influences human rights in Argentina, now, in my interviews with representatives of CORREPI, which is the human rights organization that provided legal representation for the Blasi and his family, they say that the decision to turn to the Inter-American Commission was rooted in an effort to keep the case on the political agenda after more than 6 years of judicial maneuvering in courts, okay, in order to generate knowledge around this specific case. And for those of you who are interested, a recent book by the lawyer of Walter, in which she describes her efforts and her organization's efforts in this particular case, but also addressing what are, in her view, the structural problems with policing in Argentina and the inadequacy of state responses to it. But for those, she has constructed an appendix to this book in which she describes the different turns of the case before domestic and international courts, and she calls it Walden, his judicial labyrinth. Okay, and this gives you some sense of the kind of challenges that victims of human rights violations experience, and the type of problems to try to to get the state to respond to this. So talk over here about more than 25 pages detailing the course of this case through Argentine courts. Now, the Inter-American Court, though, when arriving to the Inter-American Court, I think the Bulacio case provided an opportunity for the court to analyze extensively the type of repressive policies of the Argentine state. And it showed how repressive policing is used as a tool of social control, and it also revealed extensive judicial complicity in the ongoing practices by the police forces. So in this way, by taking the case to the Inter-American system, the representatives of the Bulacio were able to promote the rights of what are vulnerable sectors of Argentine society. And by submitting it to an international judicial process, it revealed the unwillingness and lack of capacity on the part of the Argentine state to address human rights violation. So it shows, it demonstrates the type of pressure that could be put on the state to adopt institutional reforms. And also, it also reveals some of the very real ways in which the American system can renew the hope for justice on the part of victims of human rights violations and their relatives. However, there are, of course, some very significant limitations here. In particular, when it comes to the importance of legal know-how that is often beyond the capacity of the vast majority of victims of human rights violations. There are some very real costs of bringing the case to the Inter-American system, both, of course, in terms of the resources required and the time, okay, that you have to invest in this. And, of course, this type of resources, most human rights victims, the vast majority of human rights cases, and a vast majority of organizations just do not have. So the Corepi and the family of Walter Bulacio, they turned to some legal human rights, some regional human rights organization and the major human rights organization in Argentina in order to tap into their resources for this particular case. Also, when thinking about what kind of justice does the Inter-American system actually provide? Slow justice, as you've seen. Now, as lawyers will point out, slow justice is often justice denied. So is justice really being achieved in these particular cases? In interviews with Corepi, there is a recognition that although the central recommendations of the American court were important, the real and substantive impact on the Bulacio case have been limited. Monetary reparations, yes. Recognition of state responsibility, yes. But what about concrete measures to make sure that these cases will not be repeated? As seen in a continuing stream of cases being submitted to the Inter-American system, human rights police abuses are still ongoing, of course, in Argentina. However, all these problems are clearly very significant, but I think there's some there's some important consequences, even when individual cases are not satisfactorily resolved. As argued by the lawyer of Waldo Bulacio, although we are in the same situation as we were in 1996, the important difference for her and for others is that there's more publicity around the themes that Corepi works on. That is police brutality, the conditions of people in detention. And the Inter-American system in many ways works as has a legitimating function for these organizations in terms of the type of legitimating information that these organizations provide. As the lawyer herself says, no one disputes that there's arbitrary violence by security forces in Argentina. And also, Qureti and other organizations have been able to insert themselves in societal and political debates around policing and citizen security in Argentina. In those ways, have been able to shift the debate surrounding how what role the police should have, and that they've been able to do despite what is very important, significant countervailing movements, law and order movements, if you will, that takes a very very strong strong security centered approach to policing, and crucially the organization Qureti has continued to submit cases to the Inter-American Commission, which of course reveals that they see some benefit in doing so. Okay, now against this very extensive background in this particular case and implications of this particular case, what is then my research about? So in the remaining time that I have, which I have calculated to be 20 to 25 minutes, I will look at some of the formal aspects with regards to the development of the American system and how to understand its impact. I will look more generally at the impact of how I investigate or I examine the impact of the Inter-American system in Argentina. And also, very much towards the end, I will try to just briefly highlight some of the implications of this research beyond the specific case. Okay, now, very briefly, the Inter-American system. Now, the Organization of the American State, OAS, was established in 1948, and in many ways it encapsulates, in a general sense, the regional interstate cooperation in the Americas. With the creation of the OAS, an American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man was adopted. Following this, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights was created in 1959 with a mandate to use the standards of the Declaration to evaluate the conduct of states in human rights matters. The Commission assumed the practice of conducting detailed investigations and publicizing serious violations, with a view to apply pressure on member states to remedy and reform their human rights record. However, the Commission was not given a sound legal basis, the lawyers amongst you would say, before the adoption and entry into force of the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights in 1978. So under the convention, what we have the Inter-American system as we of today, and it's in some respects it's a two-legged legal system. First, under the mechanisms of the OAS Charter, the Commission is authorized to supervise and monitor, if you will, the human rights of member states. Second, under the Convention, the Commission and the newly established Inter-American Court of Human Rights can handle individual complaints or individual petitions can be submitted to the Inter-American Commission. And the Court has a further function to provide advisory opinions on human rights. So it provides, if you will, three key functions with regards to human rights in the Americas. It monitors human rights of member states, it adjudicates human rights conflicts, and it provides an interpretive role on human rights matters in the region. With regards to the main periods of its development, of course, the Inter-American system has not developed in any way in a linear fashion, but in a way in an inevitable fashion. Perhaps you could say that three main periods with regards to its development. First, the founding of the system, and then subsequent evolution in the context of the Cold War in the region, and with regards to widespread authoritarian rule at the time. With the return to democracy, the American system played a very crucial part in shaping approaches to transitional justice in the region, that is to deal with questions of how to deal with human rights abuses under previous regimes. And it has then moved into a phase, arguably, in which it tries to address the type of human rights challenges in a regional context where electoral democracy, of course, has made significant advances, but where there are still ongoing and widespread human rights abuses. Okay, again, I could talk more in depth to this development, if you will. Now, what are some of the key features of its development, in particular when thinking about the impact of the system? I believe you could usefully divide these into three key kind of indicators, if you will, of its institutional impact. One, in terms of the expansion and increased intrusiveness of regional norms concerned with human rights and political democracy. So one of the key developments of the system, as I already mentioned, is the right to private petition. And by giving individuals and groups in the region the right to petition, it has strengthened the access of individuals to the Inter-American system. Also, it has over time developed increasingly extensive and increasingly intrusive set of human rights norms, and some legal observers claim that it's the Inter-American system in this way is very much in the vanguard of the development of international human rights law, given the very problematic setting it finds itself in. I'm not sure to what extent you can see this well, but just to give you a sense of the type of instruments that have been adopted. First thing to note, of course, is the kind of the extensive development of a set of human rights norms here. But secondly, of course, as a political scientist about to say, but someone who tries to understand politics, what you should note here is a significant regional variation in the adoption of these various human rights instruments. And again, I could talk to some plausible reason for this significant variation. But I think perhaps you could note that when it comes to socioeconomic rights, it's very slower success rate, if you will, in terms of adoption, as opposed to issues relating to women's rights. Now, in terms of the second aspect of thinking about this institutional impact, that is the type of increased pluralism, as I like to call it, of human rights politics in the region, and that's quite simply, I just mean increased number of different type of actors, both state and non-state actors, that seeks to use the Inter-American system for its purposes. Now, in contrast to the European human rights system, NGOs in Latin America play, and in America more broadly, play a far more important role in taking human rights cases to the Inter-American system. Now, again, there is significant regional variation here in the ways in which domestic NGOs try to use the political and legal opportunities provided by the system. So, of course, one aspect that I'm looking at is to understand this variation in the use of the system on the part of different NGOs. And of course, you could note here that this graph here reveals that in many ways I've interpreted as the number of cases being submitted to the Inter-American Court is not a reflection of the number of human rights violations in the country, of course, but has rather much to do more to do with the activism of local actors. So, for example, you have a very relatively low number of cases of human rights abuse being submitted by individuals and groups in Brazil, and a far higher in Argentina, and arguably the relative numbers there reveal something about the type of human rights politics more than the absolute number of human rights violations.
Is the lower axis timeline?
Timeline, the number of cases. Yes. So horizontal time. My economics tutor would really not be happy with that. However, I think beyond thinking about civil society activism, it's important to look at how domestic judiciaries used in the American system. Here, again, there is significant variation in the willingness and ability of judges across the region to make use of the type of legal norms, the legal arguments provided by the American system in their sentencing. I will talk more to that in the case of Argentina. Overall, what I'd like to make out of this when thinking about institutional impact is that there is an increasing trend towards strengthening of the domestic impact of the Inter-American system as the type of norms developed by the Inter-American system and the number of norms strengthen over time, and also the system is increasingly used by actors across the region. So the Inter-American system has adopted a more judicial approach to dealing with human rights violations. It had also another aspect of thinking about increasing, or the strengthening of the system is to look at the ratification of the different human rights instruments. And as I showed in the previous graph, there's been an increase in the number of ratifications of the regional human rights instruments. However, I would like particularly to emphasize here that to think about the question of institutional impact of the Inter-American system with regards to human rights in the region, I think it's useful to look at perhaps three dimensions of human rights politics. That is, to try to understand how the Inter-American system is shaping the process of democratization in the region by looking at how the Inter-American system addresses the human rights situation of previously excluded sectors of the population, that is to the horizontal extension of human rights in the region. So addressing issues such as race, gender, ethnicity, age. Okay. The second dimension of thinking about the impact of the human rights system is to first, of course, recognize that there has traditionally been a huge gap between the type of formal instruments of human rights in the region, and as well nationally, and actual how those rights actually are complied with in practice. So the Inter-American system provides a function of trying to deepen what are already recognized rights in constitutions across the region to make, in other words, human rights more meaningful in the region. And thirdly, with democratization across the region, in many ways the political space has widened to think about what could be socially and politically possible, and this has given an impetus to the development of new rights. And we could see, particularly with regards to rights, sexual rights, to gender rights, rights to abortion, has been a particularly important development in recent years. And I argue that it could partly be traced back to the type of activism and norms developed by the system. So just very briefly, admittedly a sketch of how to think about how international human rights law could insert itself in domestic human rights politics and exert an influence in such a way. Okay. Now, very briefly, I'd like to say, but quickly, why Argentina? Now, I could go in more into detail on the methodological problems with regards to doing a single case study when trying to understand what are more general processes. But I would just very briefly say that Argentina is a particularly important user of the Inter-American system. And of course, Argentina, with the return to democracy, opened itself up very abruptly to the scrutiny of international human rights law and international human rights institutions. So Argentina is a good case in understanding what are very subtle and detailed and complex processes of domestic change, okay? And to do this type of research, I argue, you need a very detailed understanding of the how actors behave, how they perceive change, and how did their understandings shift over time, if at all. So you need a capacity to trace the sequence of events over time in a contextualized way. So I just leave it like that in terms of methodological reasons, but I'm sure you would have many complaints as to my case selection here, but I continue to take the question and answers perhaps. Now, in my work here, I trace the evolution of the relationship between the Inter-American system and Argentina, and you could broadly categorize or put this in four different periods. What is the beginning of the relationship, the substantive relationship, which began during the time of the military regime, and this, the picture here you see very smiling Jorge Videla, was the leader of the Junta at the time of the visit of the Inter-American Commission in 1979, and you see the commissioner standing around him. He seemed very pleased, but he was not very pleased when the report was issued shortly after and distributed quite widely in Argentina. In many ways, both Argentina and the International Service argue that the Commission's report that was issued in 1980 in many ways symbolized some of the, or coincided, symbolized, if you will, with some of the changes that took place in Argentina with regard to changing attitudes towards the military regime's human rights record. With the return to democracy in 1983, the Inter-American system inserted itself in debates in Argentina regarding transitional justice. It may not have been very successful in trying to shape the ups and downs of transitional justice policies in Argentina in this period, but nevertheless, actors continued to use and draw on the Inter-American system during this period in trying to put pressure on the Argentine state to adopt more policies more conducive to human rights. In the 1990s, we saw what could be described as a consolidation of the relationship during a time that was in many ways problematic with regards to human rights, probably at the level of the Argentine accepted, but nevertheless, it strengthened the type of institutional bonds between human rights activists and organizations in Argentina and the Inter-American system on one hand, and also strengthened the type of ties between the judiciary and the system that I will get to in a moment. And we've seen, coming into this decade, a deepening of the relationship. Again, for those of you who are familiar with Argentina, you kind of see that there is a story of democratic change and change of governments here in this timeline. But with the change of governments in the beginning of this decade, we've seen a deepening in many ways of the relationship between Argentina and the system. So during this period, we've seen significant changes in Argentina with regards to, of course, the consolidation of democratic or electoral government. But of course, there are very significant human rights challenges still remaining. Now, when thinking then about the relationship and impact of the North American system, I've looked at it from three different perspectives, if you will, from the perspective of human rights organizations, from the perspective of the judiciary, from the perspective of state institutions, state bureaucracies. And what I argue here is that we have to understand the impact of the system in terms of the type of linkages that these different actors have developed over time with the inter-American system. And of course, although we're looking at it from three different perspectives, as you remember from the case of Walter Bulacio, these sectors, if you will, are very much interlinked in practice. So thinking about the impact of the inter-American system with regards to human rights groups, human rights groups in Argentina have been very active in the use of the inter-American system. Again, there's a set of explanations for why that has been the case. The picture here is from the annual report of CELS, the organization that I mentioned with regards to Walter Bulacio, which has been at the forefront of human rights activism in Argentina with regards to use of the inter-American system, but also regionally. And now increasingly CELS and representatives of CELS are going abroad to teach other organizations how to use the system for their own ends. However, although the system provides a very important set of opportunities for civil society activists in Argentina, there are some very significant constraints. And they have to do with the type of resources and time that I mentioned in the beginning, that the system demands on the part of human rights organizations. Now, quite clearly, these type of resources and time are just not available for the vast majority of human rights organizations. So, in many ways, the system, not by deliberate policy, has divided an inside-outside, if you will, division with regards to human rights activism. So, there are certain organizations that have very strong linkages with the system, including having the phone number to the relevant person at the Inter-American Commission in order to get. Which helps in the processing of specific cases, and that those organizations that just do not have the legal know-how, legal expertise of how to use international human rights instruments, and that is a problem. It's a problem it's a problem of legitimacy. Okay, in terms of thinking about, is this a system for all or a system for a privileged elite of NGO actors? And of course, it's also a question of legitimacy in terms of thinking about what type of human rights cases are actually being litigated before the Inter-American Commission. Okay, there are certain silences, if you will, with regards to certain human rights, socioeconomic rights in particular, that do not just get a proper hearing at the commission. So, in brief, the capacity of domestic human rights actors to mobilize law, mobilize international human rights law, is unequal. And for those who are concerned about politics of this, this should be something that needs to be highlighted. Okay. Now, with regards to the Argentine judiciary, we have the Argentine Supreme Court here after a recent judgment on the use of marijuana and Argentina. It's quite noteworthy that the Argentine legislation with regards to these types of substances are going in the opposite direction of what's happening in this country, but I leave that perhaps for question and answers. What I'd like to say here, though, that the inter-American system in many ways has become embedded in the domestic legal system of Argentina, partly following the 1994 constitutional reform, which constitutionalized, incorporated international human rights treaties into the Argentine constitution. So a vast range of international human rights treaties are now on par and superior to constitutional norms. Now, despite the inter-American system being part of domestic legal system in Argentina, there's significant variation in terms of how willing and able judges are to act upon this. And I could again go into this in more detail, but the variation in in judicial activity here could be explained in part on this of judicial tradition on the part of legal education and also the part of judicial independence vis-a-vis the executive in ways. And again, these type of factors to explain the uneven diffusion of the system at the local level is something unique to Argentina. It has implications more broadly in the region. Okay, I realize that I'm speeding up, but I'm getting towards the end. Now, thirdly, the formal, if you will, embedment of the American system in domestic legal system. Of course, the formal adoption of regional human rights instruments in the domestic legal system has provided an important set of litigation opportunities for legal activists in Argentina, and increasingly we've seen human rights litigation before domestic courts on the basis of American human rights norms. Okay, and again, I should mention CELS, which is an organization again at the forefront of this type of activities, which in many ways pushes the judiciary to take at least a position on international human rights norms. Okay. So again, you just note the kind of interlinked nature of the ways in which the American system works. Now, lastly, when thinking about the effects of all these processes in regards to civil society activism and judicial activism, if you will, what is crucial here is the way the state responds in terms of legislation, but also in terms of institutional providing institutional remedies for human rights violation. And of course, we have to understand what is, as I noted in the case of Walter Blasio, very problematic state responses to human rights violation, both at with regards to individual level, paying money, yes, but criminal investigation, no. And more broader institutional reforms. Now, of course, for those who are familiar with these issues, that there is, of course, a very problematic context of state administration in many Latin American countries, and the ways in which, both in terms of the scope of state administration and the efficiency of state administration. However, in my research, I like to end on a more positive note by noting and having found evidence for that there is certain forms of socialization on the part of state bureaucrats and state officials that feel very sincerely about the importance of getting to a resolution in individual cases and pushing individual reform. So there has been significant development with regards to certain state institutions in Argentina. Of course, we have the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here, which is the entity that it has the first cut, if you will, on the relationship between the Argentine state and the American system, but also with regards to the Ministry of Justice and certain provincial authorities, there have been developments towards setting up institutional mechanisms to make sure that there is proper follow-up on resolutions on the Inter-American Court and the Inter-American Commission. So human rights law has become increasingly extensive and intrusive in the type of demands that it puts on public policy formulation and implementation. And in Argentina, there have been efforts in trying to incorporate human rights in certain types of public policies. Okay. Now, finally then, to conclude, this is what happens when you are your own judge. I've slightly over time, but I just want to end on a couple of points. Firstly, of course, this is quite extensive research that I've done on Argentina, but as I've been trying to highlight throughout the talk. This is, of course, relevant to other countries in the region and thinking about the inter-American system more broadly. I've done some initial comparative study of the ratio between the inter-American system and Brazil and Chile, and there are some very interesting contrasts here. So, for example, in Chile, you have a relatively reluctant judiciary to accept the legitimacy of international human rights law, which is relatively not the case in Argentina. In Brazil, for example, you have a civil society human sector that has not been very willing or able to use the inter-American system, or perhaps not seen the point of using the system. But in recent years, you have seen an increasing tendency on the part of Brazilian human rights activists to look to the inter-American system, to actually use the inter-American system for their purposes. And looking beyond the region, of course, we have regional human rights institutions in other parts of the world. And part of the direction that my research is taking is to look at comparatively at regional human rights institutions. There are, of course, significant differences with regards to regional regimes in different parts of the world. Okay, we have a comparatively, of course, deeper, complex institutionalization of human rights in Europe, and what is a mainly promotional regime in Africa, and of course, a very incipient human rights institutions in Southeast Asia, and largely absent in the Arab world. Now, this regional variance, of course, as I've started to examine, partly reflects what could be called the cultural embedding of human rights norms across regions and patterns of state formation, legacies of colonization, so on and so forth. And while some regional human rights regimes are very willing to draw on global human rights norms, which is the case in the Americas, others, such as in Africa, very much resisting external norms. However, despite these differences, there have been, I argue, a certain degree of convergence with regards to the type of procedures and institutions set up in different regions, with regards to the type of norms that are being adopted, and also in terms of the type of activism that these institutions have generated. So I think there's an interesting agenda there of looking at regional human rights institutions comparatively, keeping in mind the type of differences that I just mentioned. Okay, I will stop there by just noting that what I hope that this type of research and wider research agenda will kind of contribute to some extent, however modestly, to thinking about the study of international human rights law at the interface of international relations. And I should add democratization. So what we have noticed, what I'd like to emphasize in my conclusion here, is that the type of changes, institutional changes, the type of changes with regards to human rights activism that we see in the case of the American system is a reflection or symptom, if you will, of broader changes with regards to how international human rights institutions work in practice today. Okay, international human rights institutions were set up by states to monitor the practices of state and try to apply pressures on states to reform human rights. What we see today increasingly is a move away from this very much state-focused view of what international institutions are, and trying to look at what some call a disaggregated state, which try to see, look at the ways in which national judiciaries interact with international human rights law, how specific states, entities and state bureaucracies interact with national human rights law, and of course how different non-state actors interact with human rights law. So we have a more complex and more fluid, perhaps, system of international human rights, but perhaps also, to end on a more positive note, one that could be used for something good. All right, let's Thank you. Right, does that mean I'm the chair of taking any questions if there are?
Chair yourself for the questions and then I'll say something at the end.
Okay, we might do, okay, all right. Right, so any questions or comments to the speaker? Please.
I know that for example, the Brazilian senior court has developed something of a reputation in its dealing with economic, social and cultural rights, and has obviously, probably with a rather similar constitution which draws on the international standard. I'm wondering if the Argentinian senior court, be it a constitutional or supreme court, has done something the same with those economic, social and cultural rights.
Thank you. Let me take each question at a time. We'll see how far we go. I think that's interesting. The Argentine Supreme Court is the one that has the ultimate word on the Argentine Constitution. It has had quite a up and down, if you will, development since the return to democracy. And in many ways, it has had a very varied constitutional jurisprudence since that time. And that variation could, in many ways, be explained by its relationship to the Argentine precedent over time. The more recent court that we had a picture of here the judges have been quite progressive in the ways in which they interpret first its own authority and two how it interprets the salience of human rights in its work. Okay, so the court under the with the Chief Justice Lorenzetti had been quite active in trying to reach out to different actors with regards to certain environmental rights issues. So it has an ongoing case with regards to the contamination of a river, Riachuelo, and there it has ruled that that the state has an obligation to clean the river. And here we're talking about very extensive financial implications for actually following up and complying with that resolution. So it has shown a willingness to engage with public policy with regards to, in this case, environmental rights. And it has shown itself to be quite innovative in opening itself up to civil society input, which in the case of Argentine judiciary has been relatively problematic. Just finding the proper tribunal where you're supposed to be monitoring a case, it's problematic. So it has become more open to input from the outside and has shown a bit more progressive nature. The ways in which it justifies that has in part political reasons, I believe, in terms of the Argentine Supreme Court during the 1990s was widely discredited, and the current Supreme Court sees it, according to the justices themselves, as part of its current role to boost its legitimacy vis-a-vis society in general, and taking a very public cases that resonate widely with the public is one way of looking at that. Yeah. So round about 20. Any further?
I'll just ask as well, how much impact is the the sort of human rights structure system have on the amnesty and the repeal of the amnesty laws after the dirty war in Argentina? Did they, I mean, were they influential in getting a clear?
I deal with this to some extent in my work. Now, the repeal of amnesty laws, for those who are not that familiar, in 2005, finally the Argentine Supreme Court overturned the amnesty laws. Amnesty laws is a broad term of understanding the type of the legislation that was adopted in the mid-80s that put a stop to human rights trials of military and police officers following the military junta. Now, the actual overturn was kind of the end point of a quite long process that in part was due to ongoing civil society activism to keep indeed this item on the political agenda throughout the 1990s, when arguably it was not a very high profile item. And in part, these activists found some willing interlocutors within the Argentine judiciary at a federal level, but lower, below the Supreme Court. And there were a number of cases on specific cases that challenged the amnesty laws and said that they were unconstitutional following the constitutional reforms of 1994. In those judgments, they're a bit conflicting in nature, but in all these judgments, at least in part, they are relying on the jurisprudence of the Inter-American Court, okay, in part, but also, basing its judgment on elements of domestic law. And one specific case that was very influential in the immediately before the 2005 decision of the Argentine Supreme Court was the decision Barrios Altos by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights with regards to the self-amnesty law in Peru. Okay, so the Argentine some Argentine judges and the Argentine Supreme Court relied on this judgment when justifying the overturn of Argentine Supreme Court. So I think the point that I'm making is that the type of influence has been gradual and over time.
And also between countries, just by their nature of being linked within this system, if laws change in one country, then it can have a knock-on effect.
Yes, that's definitely true. And in recent years in Brazil, there have been increasing moves towards challenging the laws that prevented the prosecution of military officers in that country. And in part, those who are more knowledgeable about this case than I am say that in part these type of moves can be traced back to some cases before the Inter-American Commission and the type of pressure and politics surrounding these cases that have been exerted on the Lula government. Okay. But again, there's a set of domestic political reasons for why the Lula government has seemed to be moving in recent years, I guess, even. On this particular set of issues. So again, the point that it's not so much a question of there's been one set of factors to explain domestic legal and judicial change, but it is the ways in which these factors combine.
Can I ask another question? It's a bit of a stupid one, all right? So be more. With Europe, okay, so we're part of Europe in this country, so we have to adopt European human rights laws, is that correct?
Okay, follow up on where we're going.
Well, I was thinking there's the table that you had, for example, the percentage of countries that adopted in, say, ratification on women's rights, very high, then, forced disappearance of persons. Quite a lot lower, that percentage, isn't it? So do the states get to just sort of opt in and out of the things they choose, or?
Okay, yeah, I mean, it's not a, I think it's a very relevant question. Now, there are sort of fundamental human rights instruments that all states need to adopt to become a member of an organization. Okay, so let's talk about the organization of the states. All members of the OAS, and I leave Cuba as a side, which is a particular specific case, if you will, I could talk to that. All member states of an organization of American states have adopted the charter, and they also have signed onto the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man. Okay, so those are instruments that that you have to adopt in virtue of being a member of that regional organization. Then there's a set of additional human rights instruments that are, if you will, discretionary about states to sign up to and ratify. And that explains the variation in adoption and ratification rates here. Okay. So that's a short answer. I'm not going to venture so much into the European case, but there's a similar setting with regards to the Council of Europe and the human rights instruments. Okay.
So what jurisdiction does the court actually have? So decisions made, are they normative or are they legally binding on the state?
Well, lawyers will tell you that the judgments of the Inter-American Court are legally binding. Okay. So they have the full force of legal binding decisions in international law. Political scientists then will tell you, well, you know, there's something called non-compliance, partial compliance, full compliance. So the compliance with these judgments vary, okay? So that's one issue. I should also mention, as you see here, that the American Convention of Human Rights, 71-something ratification rate, okay? The countries have not signed up to the American Convention, they're not subject to jurisdiction of the American Court. And that includes some key countries, the Organization of American States, including the US, Canada, most of the English-speaking Caribbean. Okay. Apart from that, all the other countries have adopted the charter, therefore they are legally bound by any judgments that they're subject to.
How is it enforced?
Ah, right. The question of enforcement, and part of that—that's what I like. That's my starting point with my research. Now, those who are skeptical with regards to international human rights law in general, they say, "Well, you know, this is not really domestic laws. There's no police force. There's no real kind of sanction. You know, so why should states?" Comply with? How are these decisions enforced? Well, that is true to some extent that enforcement enforcement is problematic. However, it's only problematic, if you will, if you look at it in terms of a parallel with domestic legal system. Okay. Now, there is no police force of the American states, Organization of American States, that can go and, you know, bang heads of state with, you know, the head with a big stick. However, there are other types of sticks than police in international politics. And we could go into, we could talk to that in more broad terms, but broadly it has to do with what I try to emphasize here, the ways in which domestic actors use these type of judgments, the type of decisions, the type of norms, to boost their domestic standing. And as I've been trying to briefly outline today, they do that quite successfully, given the very adverse conditions that they work in various ways. Okay, for reasons that are quite interesting, heads of states, governments, they don't quite like to be called upon not complying with international law. Okay, Now, I'm reluctant to draw the parallel here. Of course, there was a lot of discussion surrounding the decision of this country, or at least the government of this country, to go into certain conflicts in recent years, and that those were seen as a breach of international law. Now, the skeptics will say, well, they still invaded this country, and they got away with it. Well, they got away with it with significant costs, okay, in other domains. So, long story short, enforcement of international human rights law does not work in the same ways as enforcement of domestic criminal law, for example. But it works through other types of mechanisms that I'm trying to emphasize here.
Yeah. Very quickly, you said about the increase in a sort of human rights culture within Argentina. I wasn't entirely clear from your presentation. Is it possible in Argentina to launch litigation solely based on the instruments of the Organization of American States, and solely based on the international human rights instruments? Or do you need to, like in this country, if you wanted to bring a case citing ECHR principles, do you need to have an existing civil or criminal claim? So, in other words, can a member of, any member, in fact, broaden this out, any member of the OAS, can I, if I was a citizen of that country, use one of the instruments of the OAS to bring a case, or do I have to cite it or situate it within the national legal system?
I mean, in regional terms, the case of Argentina is relatively exceptional in the sense that how open it is to international human rights law. And it's open in a way that I briefly explained, that the vast range of international human rights treaties have constitutional status in Argentina. So, in effect, they are part of the constitution. That means that they are superior to domestic legislation. Okay. That means, in the case of Argentina, that this is also taking place, that individuals, human rights organizations, are taking the state to court, or taking state institutions to court on the basis of their violation of certain norms within these human rights instruments. Now, the way they do that legally, in terms of legal arguments, of course, is mixed with the type of domestic laws, right, that are in place. So whenever there's harmony between domestic statutes and international human rights law, it's not really a problem, right? The problem is when there is a conflict between what the international human rights norm dictates and what a domestic law entails. Now, the Constitution, according to the Constitution of Argentina, in that case, the international human rights norm supersedes the domestic law. Okay, that's what it says in formally speaking. Now, what I'm trying to emphasize here is that despite there being a formal side to the ways in which this works, there's there's a way that it actually works in practice. Okay, practice in terms of, well, judges may not always be that receptive to these type of arguments. They're not receptive because, in some cases, they do not agree with that type of interpretation that's before by human rights litigants. Now, part of what I argue in the case of Argentina is that judges find it more and more difficult to get away with that type of argumentation. They get away with it in countries such as Chile because there's still some ambiguity with regards to the relationship between the constitutional relationship between international human rights norms and domestic legislation. In Argentina, formally speaking, there's no such ambiguity.
Yeah. Okay. I know it's customary for the dean to chair the seminar and actually say some words at the start without the speaker. I'm afraid I just couldn't get here in time to do that, and I apologise to you all for that. especially to Pear, who had to be his own judge, one of the most exciting fruitful developments in the School of Advanced Study recently has been the establishment and development of the Consortium of Human Rights. This has already started to promote interdisciplinary activity between the Commonwealth and America's institutes, and it was a great activity. It also led to the appointment of Pear as lecturer in human rights. And the advantage of me saying these words at the end after I've heard him is that I can now say very confidently that we made the right So can I just thank you once again for an excellent and thoroughly interesting lecture today. Can we thank Pear once again?